So Dr. Dale Bresden, as we know, is going to be one of our keynote speakers at the Collaboration Cures this year. And he is directed the program on aging at the Burnham Institute before joining the Buck Institute in 1998. And he's been a president and CEO. He's a prodigious innovator in medicine with over 30 patents to his name. Notably, he put much of his findings and research into the 2017 bestseller New York Times to end the end of Alzheimer's. Michael Gelb is an innovator in airway, breathing, sleep, and painful TMJ disorders, pioneering the phrase airway-centric. And he studied early intervention for sleep disorder breathing, specializing in how it relates to fatigue, focus, pain, and the effects of all these can have on family and health. Dr. Susan Maples is an international speaker.
I didn't get that. Could you try again?
In the area of total health, the oral health and systemic health connection, and the diabetes epidemic in growing healthy kids in your dental practice. When she's not practicing dentistry, she is a leader in helping her profession really make a mark in our place in society. Dr. Jack Call, for the last 20 years has served as president dental director of the Family Health Centers Incorporated, a federally qualified community health center in Louisville, Kentucky. Additionally, he founded Dental Health Center, his private practice focusing on biological biocompatibility in dentistry. So did I miss anybody?
No, I just want to add that the four people who are on this webinar are four of the people that I absolutely respect and honor the most for not only their knowledge, but their passion and dedication to wanting to really make our healthcare system better. And I think that the way we're going to do this, we're going to start off, I'm going to ask Dale to do an overview and talk about the latest research. And then I'll ask each one of our panelists to give a short presentation, and then we'll open it up for discussion. So Dale, if you want to share your slides and give us an overview, we'll go on from there.
Absolutely. Let me share the slides here. There we go. Okay. Can you see that all right?
Perfect.
So, let's get this in presentation mode here. There we go. That's better. So first of all, thanks very much. Appreciate the honor of being part of the group here. There's so much that's going on. And I do think, just to put it in perspective, I think there are a couple of very important numbers to know. And Howard, you mentioned one, the doubling by 2050. But let's put this in perspective. Over 1 million Americans have died from COVID-19. About 45 times that number of the currently living Americans will die of Alzheimer's. So about 45 times the number that have died from COVID-19. Of course, more slowly. So we don't hear about it as much, but it is absolutely a major pandemic, one that's been going on for many years and unfortunately has been on the increase. And the second thing to say is that, people, about 15% of us will die of this illness if we don't have something to do about it. As I'll show you today, though, what's changed dramatically in the last several years is that we understand this disease so much better than we did just a decade ago. And we now have hundreds and hundreds of cases of reversal. And I'll show you one of many, many that we've seen. The other thing that's really been interesting, and I think to put this in perspective, is that as we've looked at these various factors, and that's what my laboratory group and I did for 30 years, we studied the molecular biology of neurodegeneration. What are the factors? What are the things that are actually creating the damage that leads to cell death in the brain, whether it's ALS, whether it's Parkinson's, whether it's Lewy body, whether it's Alzheimer's? What are the factors? What is the signaling? What are the changes that have happened? And what's interesting, what's come out of that, real surprises, I have to say, because so many people have looked for a simple answer. It's going to be a misfolded protein, or it's going to be a prion, or it's going to be tau, or it's going to be amyloid, or it's going to be herpes simplex. It's on and on and on and on. And what we found is quite different, that in fact, there is a network, and there are neural subnetworks, one involved in Parkinson's, one involved in Alzheimer's, one involved in Lewy body, and so forth and so on. and that we can actually define these subnetworks, and then we can look at what are the things that drive them. And ultimately, the difference here is that what we call Alzheimer's is a mismatch between supply and demand. And so it's up to us to identify all of the things that are creating the supply and the creating the demand, and why is it that these are no longer matched up? That allows us now to get far better results than have ever been achieved before. And as I say, so the point here is that none of us should get this disease anymore. People have waited and waited and waited. One of the big findings has been that by the time you get what's labeled Alzheimer's, you've had the changes for 20 years in your brain. And that was shown very nicely by serial PET scans and by serial spinal fluid analysis. So it's just like people used to talk about type 2 diabetes, and then they realized, oh, wait a minute, we can pick this up at pre-diabetes. And then they realized, wait a minute, we can pick this up with insulin resistance long before there's type 2 diabetes. Same idea here. There's no reason to be waiting for dementia associated with Alzheimer's. We can pick this up very early on. And Howard mentioned the latest research. One of the exciting things is that for the first time, there are now blood-based biomarkers that are easy, relatively inexpensive, and we should all know, just as we know our blood pressure and cholesterol, we should know our p-tau-181. We should know our A-beta 42 to 40 ratio. These things are telling us, are we headed for Alzheimer's disease? Because again, we can head it off, we can reverse it, and it's easy to reverse it in the relatively early stages. The final thing I want to mention here before the slide here is just to say, Alzheimer's has turned out, with all these different factors, as Howard mentioned, largely to be a disease of the oral nasal pharynx. That's where a lot of the action is happening, because the brain is recognizing changes related to things like mercury and changes related to changes in oral microbiome. Of course, P. gingivalis has been identified in the brain repeatedly, as have other oral organisms. So in fact, this is largely a disease that is related to your face. And the fact of the matter is, nobody should be treating Alzheimer's, and certainly won't be treating it optimally, without an oral systemic specialist as part of the team to get the best outcomes. So let me just show you some outcomes here. So first thing I want to say is the semantics of success. We've all heard so much in the last year about the approval of these groundbreaking new drugs, but people don't point out, what do they actually do? So here, if you have no treatment and you've developed either the final stage, which is dementia associated with Alzheimer's, or this the previous stage, so-called mild cognitive impairment, then you lose, as you can see here, about 3.5 points per year on a 30-point scale. If you get one of these drugs, it doesn't make you better. And this is aducanumab, lecanemab, which has just been approved as Leqembi, donanemab, which is pending approval. And these things, as you can see, they don't make people better. They don't even stabilize the disease. What they do is they slow the decline a little bit. Leqembi, which has gotten the most press here, slows the decline by 27%. That's all it does. And that is with side effects of some brain microhemorrhage, brain swelling, a few deaths in the study as well, and a cost of over $26,000 plus MRIs plus infusion. So you're looking at about $40,000 per year. And even with Medicare picking up a large part of this, you'll still, just by the fraction of that, you'll still have a quite large bill. So this RECODE is what we developed, and this is from our trial. This is freely available online in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. And you can see people didn't just slow their decline, they actually got better and they stayed better. And in fact, we have people who've gotten better and stayed better for over a decade now. So that's the other that's the other important outcome, that you can actually see people get better and stay better for years. Then let me just mention another one. So here's one example of hundreds and hundreds. This is a person who presented with posterior cortical atrophy. So this is especially affecting the parietal lobes and occipital lobes. It's one of the well-known, although less common, presentations of Alzheimer's disease. This is someone working with Carrie Mills Rutland, who's in New York City. And this particular person, as you can see, tremendous atrophy of the parietal lobe. So you can see here, less than the first percentile in her parietal lobe, which again fits perfectly. When you get posterior cortical atrophy, you have trouble recognizing shapes. You have trouble with navigation, with driving. Impossible for you to draw a clock. It's hard to recognize shapes. You often have trouble recognizing people's faces. This person went on her MoCA score, which goes 0 to 30, from 21, which is right on the borderline of full-on dementia, to 29, which is normal. Dramatic improvements. And as you can see here, her MRI reflected these. Her hippocampal volume went from 6th percentile to about the 32nd percentile. Her parietal lobe, which had been less than the first percentile, went to the 22nd percentile, and her occipital lobe from just under the 11th percentile up to the 25th percentile. So just dramatic improvements. So what did this person have? So number one, she turned out to have some recurrent herpes simplex type 1. So that was treated. Number two, she had some Bartonella, which is a tick-borne illness. That was treated. Number three, she had exposure to mycotoxins. And often these are affecting the sinuses. We see people who actually have fungus balls in their sinuses as one of the triggers. So anything that triggers one of two events in your brain can give you Alzheimer's. One, reduction in energetics. And so that's where airway, so important. So your cerebral blood flow, your oxygenation, your mitochondrial function, and your nutrients. And then the second one is inflammation. So this is where oral microbiome is so critical, whether someone has gingivitis or not, so critical, whether someone has sinusitis, whether someone has any systemic inflammation, for example, from metabolic syndrome or leaky gut. These are all things that can be identified and that can be addressed and things that are critical for best outcomes. Interestingly, this woman was getting better addressing those three things that I mentioned. And then we added EWOT, which is exercise with oxygen therapy, and she really took off and did very, very well. So this is a reversible problem. The earlier you start, the better. And in fact, it has a lot to do with oral systemic interactions. In our trial and in our new trial, we have a new trial now at 6 sites that has just started. And in that one, everyone gets cone beams, everyone's looking at oral microbiomes, everyone's looking at SpO2. And in fact, there was a nice paper just a couple of years ago showing your average oxygen saturation while you're sleeping is directly proportional to the size of your hippocampus. So as your hippocampus is shrinking, as you're getting, whether it's upper airway resistance syndrome, whether it's a sleep apnea or what have you. So the bottom line is, this is an exciting time. We are literally sitting here witnessing the transformation of these neurodegenerative diseases from hopeless to preventable, reversible, and ultimately optional. We're now opening at the Pacific Neuroscience Institute in Santa Monica, the first, and this is with the head of PNI, Dr. Dan Kelly, and the head of the Pacific Brain Health Center, Dr. David Merrill. We'll be opening the first precision medicine program for neurodegenerative diseases and expanding this now from Alzheimer's to all these others as well, including macular degeneration, including ALS, including frontotemporal dementia, Lewy body dementia, vascular dementia, all these things. So I think this is an exciting time. I'm going to stop the share there. And there's so much for all of us to do to reduce the global burden of dementia. So I look forward to seeing everybody in Florida. And again, thanks to Howard and everyone for the invitation.
Great. Thank you, Dale. And again, and what I mentioned before, we thanks to Geralyn and Apollo Health, we're gonna try to get a group of 15 practitioners. We're gonna go through the RECODE program, do testing, do all this, all the things that mentioned, maybe a little mindfulness, exercise therapy, and see where everybody is at the end of the year or so. If you want to be part of this group of 15, just send a little email to info@aapmd.org. So we're going to go through short presentations by each one of our panelists. And Jack, I'm going to ask you to go first because you were last time. So share your slides, and you're going to talk a little bit about the role of toxicity and brain function and health.
Yes. All right. Let's get this presentation mode. Come on. There we go. So as it's very well known that mercury is a bioaccumulative neurotoxin. And a couple of years ago, the FDA finally, after lawsuits and lobbying, decided to issue some warnings. And this pie chart gives kind of a breakdown of the groups of people in our population. These are individuals who the FDA recommends not have any new amalgams placed. They're still pretty conservative with their recommendations, but at least it was a start. They are not apparently going to consider banning amalgam, but as you can see, they've addressed the higher risk groups of our population, pregnant women and their developing fetuses, women who are planning to become pregnant, nursing women and their newborns and infants, children, especially those younger than 6 years of age, people with pre-existing neurological disease, kidney disease. Those are the items or areas that were highlighted in their warning. As you can see, that makes up over half the population. So the predominant exposure to mercury in our population is from mercury fillings. And the concern there is that when they're either placed or removed, there can be high levels of exposure, particularly during the removal. The IOMT has been around for 40 years, and we have been training, educating dentists on dealing with this issue, and particularly the safe removal. A few years ago, we rebranded our protocol for the safe mercury amalgam removal technique, known as SMART. And this is a certification that our academy provides to dentists, in which they receive training on all the techniques and the specifics of the protocol. I've got a few photographs here to give a little more visual as to what this even encompasses. The as you can see here in the photograph, things look a little different than the way most dentists practice today, except with the consideration of what occurred during COVID, in which there was a lot of concern about airborne pathogens, viruses, COVID, obviously. And so really a lot of what I'm describing and showing here, those who were rigorous with their protection during COVID, it's kind of a duplication of that. We do go a few steps further, but let me just point out here in this slide, you'll see we want to cover as much skin as possible with the gowns, the hair nets, the face shield is very important. Respiratory protection is very, very critical too. So in this case, I'm sitting here on the left, my assistant on the right. If you look through the face shield, you can see we've got an oxygen mask on. And so that provides us with a clean source for breathing during the procedure. And the patient, you'll see in an upcoming slide, also has, just as though they're receiving nitrous oxide sedation, they have that respiratory protection. The other important thing are these face shields, because a lot of the splatter that occurs during the removal process is then captured on the surface of the face shield that can be then cleaned up at a later time. I want to direct your attention to this horizontal white tubing or hose, which on the right side of the screen, I've just inserted what that hose is connected to. And it's a very specific, specifically designed filtration system, as it pulls the air in from the oral cavity area, and it goes through a column of specific filters that adsorb the mercury so that in the exhaust of this, there's no mercury released into the ambient air of that operatory. Now, if zooming in, again, you can see my respiratory protection, the face shield. You can see down below that, the green area, which is the dental dam. And zooming in even more, you see the dental dam. We also utilize the non-latex gloves, which are more effective at keeping mercury from contaminating through the gloves onto the skin. You can see here the patient has eye protection on. That's the orange peering through the little covering over their face, the net there. And then they have the nitric oxide mask, which in this case, the patient's just receiving the oxygen. My assistant has the white tubing that crosses the rubber dam, which is a high velocity suction that all dental staff are very familiar with, to evacuate as much of the water spray and particulate that is driven off of that surface where the drill bit touches the amalgam filling. And again, this large suction right here is the backup, because this, even though it's a high velocity suction right up against the tooth, it does not capture all the particulate. And there's been studies published regarding this phenomenon and issue, and backs up the details of our protocol and why it's effective. The other thing I wanted to spend a little time talking about is fluoride. We didn't talk about this on our last webinar, but this is heating up quite a bit within the dental field and the public. There's been more studies published, particularly over the last 8 years, and these are a lot of these studies are funded by National Institutes of Health and published in very reputable journals. There's actually a lawsuit going on against the EPA relative to water fluoridation. And as part of this lawsuit, the judge just recently issued a subpoena for the government to release a document that is being, it's been under work by the National Toxicology Program for the last 6 years. It's titled State of Science Concerning Fluoride Exposure and Neurodevelopmental and Cognitive Health Effects, a systematic review. Unfortunately, the Assistant Secretary of Health has blocked its release for over a year, but the judge issued a subpoena for its initial release of the draft. And recently, in May, there is a committee, which is the Board of Scientific Counselors, it's abbreviated BSC, and they're part of NIH, and these are independent experts, which meets periodically, and in this case, met specifically about the draft of the fluoride paper. And this fluoride report had been peer-reviewed numerous times, and so what the BCS did, they came out and made these statements here about the level of evidence. It says the human epidemiological evidence supports a conclusion of moderate confidence that fluoride is a developmental neurotoxin. Number two, that no safe exposure threshold was found for fluoride's effect on IQ. And third, that fluoride exposures experienced by pregnant women and children in the U.S. today are within the range where human studies have found reduced IQ. So I acknowledge and recognize that in dental school, we are all trained with the understanding that fluoride is one of the best preventive techniques available to us in dentistry. And it's something that that has been going on now for many decades, and yet there's new science that's come forth. And the IOMT has been on the forefront of trying to educate more and more of our dental colleagues and medical colleagues about this issue, and to take a new look at the research coming out and pay attention to some of these organizations that are trying to share the results of this research. And just in closing, I would just put forth that when the old precautionary principle, I think, comes into play here, when there's a lot of uncertainty, it's best to play it safe, be cautious. I know there's discussions and arguments about risk benefit when you have patients with high caries rate, what do you do? But there are more and more alternatives coming forward. And the concern with water fluoridation is simply that the approach of dosing individuals through the public water supply is a very ineffective and sloppy way to consider trying to provide prevention for folks. And so I'll leave it at that. And maybe if there's questions that come up further on in the discussion, we can address accordingly. Thank you.
So thank you, Jack. And I just want to share that we're happy to have the IAOMT as a partner in this year's Collaboration Cures Conference. How many years has the IAOMT existed?
Well, we started in 1984. And
you want me to do math?
Yeah, it's getting up there, almost 40 years. Yes. I typically
And I was a member since the very beginning, and this courageous group of people were able to say, we need to look at things differently. And you were looked at as quacks, but quack comes from the word quacksilver, which comes from mercury in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah.
But a lot of what you were talking about almost 40 years ago, most of it has turned out to be true and accepted into mainstream. So we're happy to have the IAOMT as a partner with all the great work, pioneering work that you have been doing and continue to do. Susan, so what are we going to do? You're going to do improv or slides or?
Yeah, I'm with you. I'll thank you. Are you ready for me?
You're on.
Okay, well, hello, everyone. I'm super grateful to be here and grateful to all of you for taking your evening this evening to learn more about Alzheimer's and the growing despair that we have around this and hope. So I actually am not able to present and share my slides because my computer is requiring an update and giving me an error code. So I'm going to actually reverse my screen and show you my slides. I think that will be easy enough to do here. Just one second. Maybe. Oh my gosh. Okay, here we go. So I'm going to show you my slides from here. Can you see that?
Yeah, if you make the view speaker for everyone out there, it'll be a bigger picture for you.
So how do I do that, Michael?
No, they can. The audience can.
Okay. All right, great.
Do it. So it'll take up our whole screen.
That's great. Thank you so much. So I come here representing Total Health, which means really for me, I'm as interested in airway health and toxicology as I am micropathogens and pathogenic causes. But representing AASH, which has its roots really in microbes, I want to give a little bit of a perspective of the microbial dilemma that we have in this very multifaceted, difficult disease all of us have been impacted by and dread for ourselves, the whole idea of this. And so when we start to look at all the different factors, it is perplexing for sure. And Dr. Bredesen has been courageous and really relentless in his pursuit of knowledge. I love this slide on intellectual curiosity that Einstein said. I'm neither clever nor especially gifted, just very, very curious. And I think all of us I know all the presenters personally, we are all super curious. And I know that Dr. Bredesen has been very curious when Howie said, we'll see if he has more for us tonight. It's only been a few months. I mean, he's really curious about what the literature says. So we're moving from looking at, what is this particular problem to, what do we know about it? And more particularly, what does the current literature tell us about it? So as we dive into the current literature on this disease, we can look at a whole bunch of different aspects from a microbial perspective. Tonight, I'm going to take a look at, just a few minutes, chronic inflammation from a peripheral infection, namely periodontal disease and gingivitis. Also, we're going to look at gram-negative pathogens, and Dr. Bredesen already mentioned one of them, PG, and we're going to look at a couple of others. We're going to look at systemic candida, a yeast as part of this, and then herpes simplex 1 as well. So without further ado, I think it's imperative that we take a look at the fact that, yes, we have predicting factors, genetic factors that are at play for many people with Alzheimer's disease. But even if you're ApoE positive with one or two alleles, we find that it's lifestyle that generally turns the light switch on, or, you know, some people use the analogy of the loaded gun, and it's lifestyle factors that pull the trigger. So we never want to give up, even if we feel doomed to this by a genetic predisposition. That's important. And Dr. Bredesen makes that point so many times throughout the book. But when we look at the gingiva as being inflamed, gingiva as being a very porous, permeable boundary, allowing gram-negative bacteria, anaerobes, to permeate through the gingival border into the bloodstream, and then, of course, crossing the blood-brain barrier and ending up in the brain. Not only do we see the presence of bacteria and its impact on Alzheimer's, but chronic inflammation, which we know brain inflammation is part of all of this. But we also see entering through the gingiva candida. Candida has never been more prevalent, partly because of, well, for a whole host of reasons. So we need to look at that. But we'll start with really quick. There are 900 identified bacterial species in the mouth, and we have some that are more dangerous than others. We tend to think of the keynote most pathogenic bacteria entering the bloodstream from the mouth as PG, TD, AA, TF, and FN, and many of us already know this. But what we have found is some of the spirochetes, especially TD, treponema denticola, are neurotropic, meaning that they live inside live neurons, and they're motile, so they travel along, or they live in, they travel along the dendrites in the brain. And I love this article, Inger Olson's article, "Can Oral Infection Be a Risk Factor for Alzheimer's?" Very, very well put, and very, I can't say it's easy to read, but it's easy to digest if you take it in sections. I also know that not only TD, but there are countless articles that Dale Bredesen had already mentioned that relate PG to Alzheimer's disease, and that is something we definitely are worried about in terms of periodontal infection. It causes age-dependent brain inflammation, neuroinflammation, and neurodegeneration. So we have some, just multiple studies that agree that we have to take into the importance the holistic treatment in a dental office, that not only are we trying to create white tight gums, but we also want to shift the microbial profile so that we don't have these dangerous pathogens. Two things that periodontal infection and Alzheimer's have in common, as Dr. Bredesen already said, I feel like I'm repeating so many things he said, but that we don't see symptoms until they're late stage. So periodontal infection comes way before, asymptomatically, way before there are symptoms. And so does Alzheimer's. By the way, so does cardiovascular disease in general. And we have to recognize that they also both occur in all ages, in many ages. So although we associate Alzheimer's with older people, we definitely see cognitive decline in younger people, and we see evidence of that younger and younger as it goes on. So with periodontal disease, by 30 years old, half of our population has periodontal disease. And by 70 years old, 70%. Those are pretty easy numbers to remember, but they're so incredibly prevalent, even though they're generally asymptomatic. We can literally, by detecting in a drop of saliva or spitting in a cup, swishing with some saline, we can identify the most significant pathogens. The report that I'm showing you here shows 11 pathogens, and out of 11 that we've tested, 9 of them are present in this patient's mouth and above threshold for cardiovascular disease. And again, if you look at the levels of PG and TD, they're way above threshold. So when we're looking at trying to make a significant difference for a patient, what you'll see here is that we're bringing these pathogens not only out of sight, but way below threshold. So in this case, PG and TD are gone or absent. And that's really what we're looking for. We don't consider ourselves finished with periodontal disease treatment until that change has occurred. And by the way, while the American Academy of Pediatrics says that we can only sort of treat this disease as it comes episodically, we really don't believe that at ASH. We really believe that we can get the patient on the right foot for stabilizing this forever. When we look at facultative anaerobic candida species, we also are quite concerned. It's become the fourth most common cause of nosocomial infection. And the rate of candida shifting from candida albicans, which is most easily treated with nystatin and fluconazole, we now see the non-albican species increasing tremendously. Glabrata, Pelizaeus, Tropicalis, and Crucea especially. So these yeast infections are very difficult to treat because we don't really have treatment for them. We don't have easy medications for them. And why are we seeing such an increase? Well, especially because we have hyposalivary function, in other words, dry mouth. And that a lot of that is from polypharmacy, many medications that patients are on, also antimicrobial rinses, steroids, gut dysbiosis, decrease in gut microbiome from the decrease the diversity of food that we're eating, so lack of diversity in our diet, and ultra-processed food in general, which is high in sugar and feeds candida. So we see this quite commonly. And when we, again, spit in a cup and identify what species they are, it's up to us to try to figure out how to solve that. And if nystatin and fluconazole doesn't work, what does? We typically look at lifestyle, eliminating ultra-processed foods, especially sugar, adding in high fiber and whole grain foods, reducing or eliminating alcohol intake, reducing stress, looking for autoimmune disorders, improving sleep quality and quantity, very important, demedicating safely where possible with the help of their physician. And then we do have some pretty helpful naturopathic remedies, a supplement that there are a few of them on the market. This is one that we use very prevalently. It's called Candacid Forte, and it has botanicals such as berberine and oregano, rosemary, cinnamon, ginger. So I think that in dentistry, we have gotten accustomed, I guess, culturally to thinking that we're going to solve this disease with a piece of string and a nice brush and a sharp instrument. And this is not what solves a microscopic microbial infection. It really doesn't. It, again, is a very difficult multifactorial disease, just like Alzheimer's. It has multiple avenues that require help. Scaling and root planing is just one of the ways that we can help. And the reason we rely so much on that is because that's where the money is. We don't get paid for diet counseling or helping, you know, coordinating with their physicians to help them demedicate or getting them off, you know, systemic steroids or antibiotics. We don't get paid for that. So unfortunately, it's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it. That's an old quote by Upton Sinclair, but it's never been more true than the way we bill in dentistry today. But getting off the what I call perigo-round, where we're treating people for a periodontal infection over and over and over again and blaming the patient for not brushing and flossing adequately, is tough. It requires that we take a look at other factors. So what elements would we truly have to look at to create periodontal stability once and for all? Well, there are a whole host of oral factors and a whole host of systemic factors that we need to identify in each and every patient. This is individualized, personalized medicine. And we need to, with patients, and help them figure out how to turn some of these factors around in order to get microbial shift that will dictate stability, reducing the risk of cardiovascular disease and Alzheimer's dementia. So we do what we call perio bundling, where everything that the patient needs is included in the treatment therapy at one fee. So we don't have to go back and try to, you know, continue to add on all of these codes. And so that's kind of what's in what, you know, so many factors that are involved in our treatment therapy. But if anybody's interested in this brochure, it's a patient brochure that we created explaining what the treatment modality is and what is included. I'm happy to forward that. This is my email address and my cell phone number. If you'd like to receive that, just email me. If you can't read it, it's susan@drsusanmaples.com. And I just wanted to say this. This is a poem that my grandmother had on her refrigerator that she required us to memorize at a young age. And it says, "You're sure you're right? How fine and strong. But were you ever just as sure and wrong?" We've been wrong about so many things. And some of the things that you're hearing tonight are just beginning to unfold and develop. And some have been very tried and true. But please, please be curious about the literature. Stay with us. There's no better place to learn than with a group of people who are hungry for learning. And that is what you will find at Collaboration Cures. So I hope that you join all three organizations and that you come and study with us and be part of a movement that is continuing to look for research to support patients' health in a world that needs so much guidance in the area of helping people become their best and most healthy selves. So I appreciate your time and attention, and sorry about slide quality.
Susan, I'm creating a new award for you. You're going to be the MacGyver of webinars. We can drop you in a webinar on any planet in the solar system. And you'll figure out how to do it. Kudos.
Thank you, Howie.
And
thank you.
If you send me the slides, we will add them to the recording of this webinar so people can see them. A little bit of the borders were a little bit cut off.
So I absolutely will do that.
So just look at what an incredible group of panelists we have here, leaders and. But their knowledge is far surpassed by their passion. Coming on, being part of this webinar, sharing their information, and their really belief that we all can help change the healthcare system. And God knows it needs to be changed because what we have now isn't really working at all. We're throwing more money at it, and we're not really getting better. So a final presentation. Before we open it up to question, Michael Gale, my co-author, every Thursday morning we have a discussion. We always talk about what is it? What is the piece that we're missing? There's always a piece that we're missing. So, Michael?
Howie, thank you. And it's great to be on with Jack and Susan. And this is what Collaboration Cures is about. It's IAOMT and Jack talking about the toxins and Susan and Ayash talking about pathogens and oral systemic effects. And really Howie and I talking about this hidden problem of airway. And I want to thank Dale and Apollo Health. I just got certified, Howie's certified in the RECODE protocol. And without giving away too much of Dale's slides, I want to go over just some basics. So let me get this out of the way here. And I don't want to show more than Dale shows. So I'm going to go over this kind of quickly. I'm here tonight to talk about the sleep and the airway component. And when you hear Dale speak, you are going to hear about the Bredesen 7. I'm not going to go over it too much, but you're going to hear that from Dale Bredesen. And I really encourage you all to get your team certified in the RECODE protocol, because the outcomes of this Bredesen 7, which we can see above, is to promote neuroplasticity. But when we look at airway and we look at sleep, it's not only energetics providing energy, with oxygen and blood flow, when you treat the airway, it also affects the microbiome. It affects it's the oral microbiome, the gut microbiome, and the effect on the brain microbiome, and all three biomes talk to each other. Certainly, when we treat airway, we reduce systemic inflammation. The reason there's a bed underneath this triangle of metabolic health, which is known to involve diet, fasting, and exercise, when Howie and I speak, we think that sleep and airway is the foundation for making metabolic health work and really improving the effect of the diet, improving the effects of fasting, improving exercise. Fight in the recode. Cover. Sorry, Dale, for showing this. I'm going to go briefly, but you know, inflammatory sleep is a big part for me of inflammatory. And we're going to talk about systemic inflammation. It's a part of the suite, which is insulin resistance. Certainly, sleep apnea is very closely tied in with insulin resistance. And, you know, there's a lot I could discuss with you, Dale, but trophic factors, you know, Chip talks about trophic factors, and maybe I guess you would consider oxygen as being one of those trophic factors, and certainly vascular. I'm not going to prolong and go into detail on these, but certainly sleep in terms of inflammatory is, Dale's program and Recode is very aware of that. We talked about the suite. And in terms of, Dale mentioned energetics and oxygenation. And, you know, my mind, I've been involved in sleep for 30 years, and this puts new perspective on it by including all of this in the Bredesen 7. We talked about insulin sensitivity. I'm going to get in a second because I don't want to go into too much. If you want to get the details on this, you want to come to the AAPMD conference down in Orlando, September 7th to the 9th. This is basically an introduction. And so for the dental community here, if you were at the American Academy of Dental Sleep Medicine and you heard Dave Rappaport's talk, when we talk about sleep, we talk about ventilatory, the ability of the lungs to basically expand, to work properly. When we talk about sleep apnea, we talk about hypoxia. Dale mentioned the paper that talked about MeNO2, and I wanted to talk to Dale more about that because when I went into the details of that paper, it was 93% and below, and then it was 94%, 95%, 96%. I want to get Dale's opinion on, does he think that someone who has a MeNO2 of 94% or 95%, where we ideally want it to be 98, 99, how much does a MeNO2 of 94% even contribute? You know, everyone talks about below 90, but in this paper on MeNO2, it was 93, 94, 95. So I think that's a good question. We're seeing this, a narrowed airway. That's what we see when we look in the patient's mouth and we look on cone beam. This is our airway-centric concept, which we'll expand upon. And it should just be reiterated that sleep-disordered breathing is a continuum, which really starts with mouth breathing in children. And Susan's very involved with the Endeavor Group, and APMD is very involved with that. But let's remember that this starts in children and it doesn't go to full-fledged sleep apnea. It usually starts with snoring, with mouth breathing, and even upper airway resistance syndrome. So there's probably enough on this one slide to be a whole lecture. But if you look at G. Levy's book and you look at the latest edition, there's really five reasons why you should care about airway and sleep. The number one complaint from patients that come into my practice, both in the city and in White Plains, is I'd like to feel more refreshed. So the number one reason we sleep could be argued as fatigue reversal. I want to recover during the night and I want to re-energize. But in terms of this lecture tonight, I love the term biochemical refreshment. Because we learned from Dale that it's about neuroblastic, it's about neuroplasticity. And even G. Levy is saying that when we sleep through the night and get a restorative sleep, we get synaptic efficiency. We get glymphatic lavage. What does that mean? Well, that's the glymphatic. That's clearing toxins from the brain as we get into deep sleep, slow wave sleep. Dale talks about neurogenesis. Neurogenesis is the reversal and the prevention of Alzheimer's disease. We get neurogenesis when we get idealized sleep with proper oxygen, less arousals, and proper ventilation. We get metabolic restoration and growth. We need sleep for memory consolidation. So if we don't get proper stages of sleep, we're not talking about oxygen, we're talking about sleep architecture. So we need enough REM sleep, we need enough slow wave sleep, because sleep seems to facilitate the encoding of new material. It helps us learn, it helps us put things into memory. And it may also facilitate the learning of simple tasks. Now, Alzheimer's disease is also associated with depression. And it shouldn't be understated that one of the main reasons that we sleep is our psychological well-being. Because lack of sleep presents a risk of mood alteration and even depression. And this is just from getting, these are the side effects just from not getting not enough sleep. And you can see that cognitive impairment is number two on the list. And memory lapses or loss of memory is number three on the list. So for me, the reason I'm doing this, the reason I got into this, the reason I'm so passionate about this is that it's about the brain. It starts with children with ADHD and it goes to adults affecting the hippocampus and the other areas that Dale mentioned. But if number one's fatigue reversal, number two is biochemical refreshment, and then memory for sure, and then psychological well-being. And, you know, we just came through COVID, we could throw in immune function as well. So I'll go another couple of minutes and then we'll open it up. Let's see if I have. So the main thing with GASP is that for many people, and I know this for myself just personally, I've been talking to Howie quite a bit. This is the hidden path to complete health. Because men are in denial, and I was in denial for many years. Men do not think they have a problem. So this stuff creeps up on you, and we will advocate for home sleep testing, diagnosis, diagnosis, diagnosis. And it's all part of the RECODE protocol. And just a couple of these. So the reason that I've been showing the slide for about 10 or 15 years, just understand that when you get upper airway collapse and you get sleep apnea, you get one of two things typically. You get either intermittent hypoxia, which you see the graph on your left, or you get sleep fragmentation, disturbed sleep. And we've always known that as a result of that, both the sleep fragmentation and the hypoxia, we get everything from systemic inflammation to oxidative stress to hypothalamic pituitary adrenal activation. And what does that lead to? insulin resistance. If that's not enough, we also, part of the systemic inflammation is the increase in interleukin 6, tumor necrosis factor alpha, high sensitivity C-reactive protein. And this shows you, this is for cardiovascular disease, but like someone, if someone told you 25 years ago that you could prevent cardiovascular disease, you probably would have laughed at them. Well, Dale Bredesen is the first one that's really come out and saying, we can prevent Alzheimer's disease. And it's not the same model. He's got a unique model. And I think I'm going to stop my share there. And if you want to learn more about all this, come down to Orlando and visit us at...
Good.
All right.
So I think the thread of the conversation is how important collaboration is, because each of us may have a knowledgeable piece of the pie, but the program only works, as Dale said, when you find all the holes in the roof, because if you don't fix all the holes, you're still going to have a very wet house if you don't fix them all. And the challenge is, because Dale has been doing this for quite a few years, is if I know that I can be a part of reversing and preventing Alzheimer's, why would I not want to be involved? And I welcome the opportunity to become WeCode certified. The challenge is, why doesn't everyone want to do that? So I'm going to throw this question up into all our people on this call. Why would you not do this? Why would you not want to participate in this? And I'd be curious to see what people have to say about that. And I was telling Jack earlier that I did my last mercury filling in 1970. And I had some people who did really well when I removed their mercury fillings, some people who didn't. Then when I became more involved in airway, and I went back and looked at those patients who didn't do well, after I treated the airway, then they did better. So it is so important that there be a collaborative effort. I think it's great. I love what Dale has to say about looking at oxygen desaturation. Every time, whether at night or during the day, where oxygen levels fall below a certain level, it's a little insult to the brain, and one insult after another over years and decades creates a problem. Mercury fillings or periopathogens or trauma or bad diet all adds little insults. And in our view of health, we don't look at health as being little things one added to the other. We look at one problem, one disease, one medication, and not only about, it's about changing our mindset, looking at things differently. Let me see what there, so well, anybody want to comment on that while I see what somebody wants to share? Greg Campy raised his hand.
Yeah, if I could just mention, you know, we all came through classical training, and when I trained, you trained to be a neurologist or a neurosurgeon or an otolaryngologist or an oral surgeon or what have you. And of course, that's just not the way the body works. And so this is why it's so critical for all of us to be interacting and communicating, because it has shocked me as a neurologist and in neuroscience. Looking at brains, I have been shocked at how much that's in the mouth ends up in the brain, whether you're talking about mercury toxicity or airway, as we've heard, or microbiome or any of these things. It's just amazing, the communication. And I think we're seeing this more and more. And of course, there's more and more now on communication between the gut and the brain. So the communication is remarkable, and it's just very difficult to do, to get best outcomes by only focusing on your specialty. And I see this all the time, and from other neurologists, well, we just do this. We're going to give a medication. We're not going to look at all these other things. And of course, they don't get very good outcomes. So this is where I think, interaction, we can get much better outcomes. And before you go on, I'd love to have one question for Dr. Gell, but that was a really interesting presentation. So my question is, so many of the people we see fit exactly with what you've said. They have small airways. They've often had braces. They may have had some allergies when they were kids. They've had their whole life of snoring. They have to sleep on their sides. Their oxygen saturation is low. What's the best thing you would recommend for them? Do you open their airways? I know there are groups that do that. What is the best thing today that this panel recommends for these people who are, by the way, a large part of the number of people that we see?
Such a loaded question. Oh my goodness, Dale. It's an individualized, personalized approach. I don't want to answer for Michael, but I mean, just like anything, there's so, we have a host of remedies that people, last night, AAPMD had a webinar. I don't know if many of the listeners were on there, about a very becoming a famous podcaster who's talking about just opening up avenues for people to see that there are many different approaches depending on the individual and how badly they want to treat it, from an organic nature versus wearing a CPAP or a mandibular advancement appliance or a hypoglossal nerve stimulator or, yeah. But it's a personalized approach. Michael, what would you say?
What I would say is, Dale, we want to start at 2.5 or 3.5 on the road to preventing Alzheimer's. We're starting opening up airways at a very, very young age.
Great idea.
And I love what you said. And I've been talking about slow wave sleep predicts Alzheimer's by 20 years. Yeah. So I love what I learned in RECODE, that you have to start 20 years. But I've been saying for a long time, and Howie says this, we start forgetting things in our 30s and we start forgetting things in our 40s. And it's like cancer. It's like diabetes. This thing is very slow progressing, and you take nicks and it happens very gradually, and it's insidious. Yep. When I talked to my cardiologist, he said, Michael, it was really hypertension and diabetes. These things that come silently, that no one gives you the warning that you have an airway problem. Yep. And for so long, it's been overlooked, just like all Alzheimer's, and starting with airments, that we just say, I'm getting old. But Susan's part of this effort that we're starting with very young children. Howie's supported with AAPMD. We're the ones that are on board starting at the earliest. So with airway, we know it can start at birth. And so we want to be part of that program, but early intervention. And we say earlier and then earliest. And yeah, you gave us a great message.
So Dale, when Mike and I started the APMD, one of the very first speaker at our very first meeting was a woman named Karen Monick, who's an epidemiologist at Albert Einstein. And she did this cohort study, 11,500 people, and showed that kids were not sleeping well, did not learn well, their brains do not function well. So it's sort of like sort of Alzheimer's of childhood, where you don't get sleep, your oxygen drops during the day, you don't learn, and then you don't build those brain connections that allow you to function better in the world, and then so you're already starting with two strikes against you. So the challenge is to be able to see these problems 20, 30, 40 years, 50 years. When Michael and I started the APMD, we want to put ourselves out of business. We should never have to see the adults we see, because these people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s all had these problems when they were kids. And that's where things have to change. I love the work you're doing. And I see the challenge, as you said, how do we rethink how we think about things? We all have become experts in our field. How do we become anti-specialists, where we say, who else do we have to bring onto the team in order to provide the best service for a patient?
You know, Howie, if I could add one thing to that, it wasn't until the late 1700s, which is a blink of an eye ago in the human race, that we actually separated the body into systems for study. So while as Dale, you said, it is not the way the body functions in separate sections, but it is the way that we separate the research and look at it. And unfortunately, as Maslow said, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. The medical student today has at least an introduction to all of these systems, except the mouth. When they took the mouth out of the body and gave it to the dentist, they eliminated it from the medical school curriculum. So unfortunately, 85% of physicians are not looking for pediatric airway disorders or sleep-related breathing disorders, and 76% of physicians for adults are not. That's why that's why we have now deemed this, you know, the dentist's responsibility, because there are telltale signs in the mouth that show up even before the symptoms. And we are much more apt to be able to recognize those than physicians. We need to get more and more physicians at Collaboration Cure so we can show them and they can speak to us. We need to be able to speak each other's language from every single subspecialty in medicine. We have to start understanding each other, and that's how we'll come together. And I believe that something like Collaboration Cures is the place to do it. So we're grateful you're speaking there, Dr. Bredesen.
Grateful for the invitation. Thank you.
Dr. Bredesen, a few people have asked about things crossing the blood-brain barrier, perhaps taking medications that help mitigate silver coming into through the body, mercury coming in through the body, crossing the blood-brain barrier. I mean, she's saying, one of the people was asking, well, if we take supplements that will block that happening, is that going to lower incidence? So can we do that with supplements? I mean, most of us know that supplements, you know, a good portion of them are diuresed by the time they get down your gullet. So,
yeah. You know, I think one of the more interesting studies came out just a couple of years ago where a group looked at how long would your blood-brain barrier be able to exclude candida. And so they actually did intravenous injections in rodents of candida. And the idea was, is it going to be how many weeks, how many months? Because everyone knows the blood-brain barrier is so tight. It's got these amazing astroglial feet that are supposed to keep it so tight. And the answer was a couple of minutes. So these things work their way into the brain within a couple of minutes. And so, you know, this idea that the blood-brain barrier excludes, yes, certain things it excludes, especially charged large molecules, but it's not very good at excluding organisms like candida, as we heard earlier, you know, from Dr. Maples, such an interesting area. And of course, gut health, I mean, it's, you know, it's a recurrently important organism. And then at the same time, the idea that you're going to somehow tighten it up to exclude things, well, yes and no. It is true that in general, leaky gut is associated with leaky brain. So that, yes, if you've got a leaky gut, there's a good chance that your blood-brain barrier is not particularly efficient. And it should be pointed out that one of the earliest changes in Alzheimer's, and again, as was mentioned earlier, that is one of the things that's changed. When I trained, Alzheimer's was a disease of your 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. Now we understand it's really a disease of your 30s, 40s, and 50s that is diagnosed 20 years later. So there are so many things we can do very early on. Again, just like pre-diabetes, same idea. And so I don't think the idea of just keeping your blood-brain barrier closed with a supplement is going to be helpful. With the exception that, yes, make sure that you don't have a leaky gut, because no question that can contribute to a leaky brain. And again, one of the earliest changes you see in Alzheimer's is a change in the blood-brain barrier. So, you know, I would, again, recommend look at your oral health, look at your gut leak, make sure that you optimize your organism, your microbiome. We have people in our trial just doing dental siding seem to be helpful for some of these people. So it's something that's, you know, that's that general, improving their microbiome and getting rid of their gingivitis, getting rid of their abscesses. As we heard, of course, airway, so important. And of course, mercury. So many of these people, one of the first patients I saw way, way back 2013, who got tremendous reversal and did beautifully. His big problem turned out to be he had massive amounts of mercury. So these things are all addressable. But again, not in, you know, one thing, just taking a supplement and kind of closing up our blood-brain barrier. It's unfortunately not quite that simple.
Well, I think Stasia Gominek probably said it pretty well, because there's such a connection between things like low D, gut biome, and OSA and or neurotoxicity, because, you know, you've got these girls coming in with tingling hands, chronic headaches, migraines, and whatnot. You give them a sleep study. You know, put them on a CPAP, they have zero apnea, and yet you put them on a CPAP and they feel better. And then you give them a B50 and vitamin D, next thing you know, the tingling in the hands and feet are gone. So yeah. I think our culture, unfortunately, is that of a siloed medical system. So breaking down the silos is probably one of our first things we need to do. And the other thing is the hardest part of collaboration, which we have found over the years, is getting people to take a deep breath and say, okay, what I thought and believed before as a real truism and the paradigm of the life that I'm going to living, I have to put that aside and do something new. And as a provider, that's super scary.
Yeah. We are in a period of great change, which is really exciting. We're seeing things that we've never seen before. And I have to say, you know, many of my colleagues will say, well, it's impossible. You can't do this. You know, you can't reverse cognitive decline. Why should we be looking for this early and all this? And there is so much that's changing. And I would add, one of the things that's changing, and we're seeing repeatedly in people who present with migraines, of course, CGM. So continuous glucose monitoring. And I'm sure that people here have been using this. Very important. And you often see it in association with migraines. So things are changing so radically. And I think that, you know, 5-10 years from now, it's not going to be surprising that Alzheimer's is optional.
Yeah. Well,
now, one of your original slides, looking at how these new drugs come out, this is so great. We can slow the decline by 20%. And a lot of healthcare is managing something so that the rate of decline becomes slower, whether it's diabetes or Alzheimer's or whatever. But that doesn't have to be the way our healthcare system is focused, because we now know that so many of these things, diabetes, heart disease, cardiovascular disease, can be reversed. And that's why we're really excited about having this collaborative group who we may have different things we believe in, but we all believe that health can be changed. It doesn't have to become the slow downward spiral. It can be reversed, you know, and I'm the eldest spokesman of this group, 82, and I'm still here. And if I listened to everything my conventional doctors told me, I probably wouldn't.
Exactly.
But it's being involved with all of you people that gets me excited and passionate about everything that has to be done. So Pat McBride, my monitor, says it's time to wrap it up. I implore everybody who's on this is come to Collaboration Cures, learn more, consider getting involved in RECODE, that whatever your practice is, you have something to offer. It is so interesting to learn what you can contribute. And I need a few more people to fill out our group of 15. Come and go through the process with us 1 year. the best way to teach your patients is to lead by example. And this would be a great way to do that. Interested in joining our group, info@aapmd.org. And Dale, you can have the last word because you're our star guest.
Thanks very much. Actually, I'm just telling Michael here, yes, I'd love to get some slides from him. That's great. I think that, again, this is a new era. Please throw away this old claim that there's nothing you can do. I love what you guys are doing with the young kids, because we realize now that these chronic illnesses, including Alzheimer's, including cardiovascular disease, these really get started. That are impacting this from a very, very young age. And unfortunately, as you mentioned, Howard, the standard doctors are just throwing another drug that's kind of circumventing the problem and really not doing very, very much. So I look forward to more and more interaction with the oral systemic specialists, because it's the only way that we're going to get the best outcomes for people with cognitive decline and, of course, ultimately prevent cognitive decline in the vast majority of people. So let's all work together to reduce the global burden of dementia. And thanks very much again to everyone.
And Pat,
thanks everybody.
We finished right on time.
So thank you, everybody. Have a nice evening. We really appreciate the time you've given to AAPMD, AOSH, and IAOMT. Goodbye, my friends, all of you. Thank you for your evenings. I know it's very late for some of you. And for those of us on the West Coast, we still have maybe a minute or two of sunshine left. So
good night,
take
everybody.
Care, and we'll see you.
See everybody in Florida.
All right. See you then.